Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 70 on Tuesday, the 1st of November, 2016. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, I'm Andrew. And how are you, Alan?
Better than I was this time last week, actually. No, I'm pretty good. How's about you?
Not too bad.
Coping with the joys of half term.
Yes, something like that. No, actually, it's not bad. Our school is on a different timetable to others, so it's fairly quiet.
All right. That's not so bad. It was It was kind of quiet news-wise this week until today, really, wasn't it?
People came back into work.
I know, that's it, isn't it? Yeah. So a long weekend, come back and shut down some motorsport programs. So last week, Audi announced that they were going to pull out of the World Endurance Championship and the Le Mans program for racing and switch their efforts to Formula E instead from the very end of the season. All 300 employees are going to stay. But their focus would switch to providing support for the Ab Schaeffler Audi Sport Formula E team. Brand has lent its name to the team, so hence the Audi Sport bit, since Formula E began, but it's now officially providing what's quoted in this Autocar article as financial and technical support to the team.
But it's not VW leaving WEC, though, is it? Because Porsche will still be there.
Oh, no, Porsche will still be there.
So that sort of sounds a bit like they are going to have one brand in a racing format.
That does seem to be the setup, because the other announcement which was made today was that Volkswagen have decided to quit the World Rally Championship, which of course still leaves Skoda in the World Rally Championship. And I guess if you are cost cutting and you want to still make sure that you've got a sort of finger in each motorsport pie, then you want to make sure that you've only got one. You know, you're not competing against yourself and spending research money against yourself in all of these. Because, I mean, they're still, at the time of recording, Volkswagen are still in...
Without us checking the internet, yes, right now.
Hang on, let me just do it. Do I have tweet up? No. All right, just 130 tweets since I last looked. No, there's nothing about any Volkswagen Group companies pulling out of DTM.
Well, you really know they were in trouble if they did that.
They really would be in deep poo if that was the case. So it looks like it's going to be Audi in Formula E, Audi in DTM. I've no idea where Volkswagen are going to be. Porsche in World Endurance Car, Skoda in World Rally.
So what's Seat in?
Well, if they've
do they have their own race series?
They had they their used own. To. I'm sure they. Yes, I'm sure
they're
still
supposed
have their
to be
own
the sporty
series.
Wing, weren't they?
Well, they were. They were meant to be the Spanish Alfa Romeo. I honestly don't know. I don't know. Answers on a postcard, please, to @motoringpodcast on Twitter, or info@motoringpodcast by email, or any of the other usual route. Facebook, Instagram, I guess, if you want to send that kind of thing by Instagram. That would be weird. But yeah. So, basically, Volkswagen are rationalising their motorsport efforts. That amount will be a tiny, tiny amount compared to the amount they're having to pay out over Dieselgate. But, yes, every little helps, etc., etc.
Yes, quite. So, more follow-up?
Well, yes. I wasn't quite sure if it was follow up or news, so it kind of sits straddling the two of them.
It must be follow up now because we've mentioned it. But earlier than we anticipated or were led to believe, we would be told the answer to the question of will Nissan stay in Sunderland? We find out that Nissan will stay in Sunderland.
They will, yeah.
Following, there were some wonderful quotes that came out on the back of this. Following assurances that UK would seek a tariff-free deal. Yes. I think it was perhaps a little bit more than that, because that otherwise means that Nissan were told, well, we really want it to be a nice deal. Is that okay? Oh, good, you'll stay. Mm-hmm. Which, no, that didn't happen. I know we've, and this is not to try and be too political in this.
We're going to fail miserably.
Well, it's so tricky. But I know recently we've had politicians from all persuasions choosing to be liberal with things like truth and fact. So for them, why I was surprised that they would continue in this vein now, I have no idea, and my own naivety. Apparently it's also been announced that the same will be offered to other manufacturers based in the UK.
Yes.
So effectively, the government has announced very early on, before they've even got to a negotiating table, they are ring-fencing automotive as a special case.
And according to this, the Bloomberg article that we'll be linking to in the show notes, the now Brexit Secretary David Davis published an article on a Conservative website back in July saying that there was a great deal the government could do to help car producers if the EU did insist on imposing tariffs, and those include research support, investment tax breaks, lower vehicle taxes, a whole range of possibilities to protect the industry and the consumer. So there's no way they can just make this applicable to Nissan. It has to be much, much wider for the automotive industry as a whole.
Yeah. I mean, what I want to say, though, because I'm sounding like I'm a little bit negative here, I want to say it's brilliant news for the UK.
Yes. Oh,
and it's
absolutely
brilliant news for Sunderland, because that could have been such a devastating blow. As we talked about last week, you know, it's a third of the production exports from this country, or is it production?
It's a third of the production comes from there, 80% of which is exported.
Yeah, so, you know, it's such a massively important
facility.
Facility to that area and to the UK, that them choosing to be satisfied with what the government has said they will provide for them, no matter what the outcome, that they are continuing to invest here. Because there was an article that came out today on Autocar, which again will be linked, that makes it clear that Nissan would have just gone. If they didn't get the, which is what we talked about as well. I mean, you know them better than most people, Alan. You know, as a company, on how they operate. But I mean, we grown ups knew that.
Yes.
If they couldn't get the assurances they need, they'd be off, because they're there to make money.
And you've got to remember there that it's not, as I said last week, and I'm going to keep on repeating it because everybody thinks about Sunderland, you've got to remember that there's their whole European Technical Centre is based just outside Bedford, and of course there's a whole design team based in Paddington there as well. And it's not just that that in Sunderland they employ, there was a
7,000
infographic thing, 7,000 7,000 direct employees. There's a whole bunch of contractors.
Something
there
like 28,000 other jobs connected.
And I think it's around the 25,000 mark of extra support and supply chain. If you do go up there, if you are ever in the northeast, and you fancy a scenic look at the outside of a blooming big shed, then if you go round. You go around, it's just off the A19, isn't it? I think it's the A19, but you can see that it's easy to spot the Nissan factory because it's the one with all the windmills up above it. And there's it's not just the plant itself, which is massive. It's all the surrounding, the surroundings as well. There's a whole sort of technical university outpost beside the plant. There's all the logistics warehouses that butt straight onto it. There's all the stuff at Port of Tyne, for example, where most of these vehicles are exported from. So, you know, it's a big infrastructure that relies on it, and I'm really pleased that Nissan have enough faith in our politicians to basically continue using that where they could quite easily have relocated all of that overseas.
Mm. So, because yes. I mean the problem with whatever has been assured, mm-hmm. rather than just words, which is the implication that some of the politicians are trying to make out, that we've just mm-hmm. told them we're going to try really hard and that was enough, is that it depends under whose rules we will be doing trade in the future.
Yes.
If we are somehow connected with the EU, then we can't, the government cannot support. It cannot be seen to be doing state support for a plant. And under WTO rules, because that's another option that keeps being thrown out there, even though the financial penalties seem to be quite harsh, mm-hmm. From the little I've gleaned on it, again, there cannot be state sponsorship. You cannot have state preferential treatment and things like that, apparently. So... I mean, I'm glad I'm not involved in trying to unpick this knot.
No, I'm sure we will be no more protective of our native manufacturing than, say, the French or the Germans are. I'm sure that we will be at least at their standards right the way through this. So that can't be an issue. Cause, yes.
So, in short, good news for
Renault. That's a level playing field.
Good news for Sunderland, and I am really delighted at this day, because that was going to show how the country was going to go. I think it was mm-hmm. the first real big challenge, and I don't think the government had any other choice but to offer as much assurance as it possibly could.
No. No, I don't think I had any choice there either. So no, I'm really pleased. I mean, that was my first reaction was yes, because yay British manufacturing. Mm. So yeah, dead pleased that that's the case.
Right, let's move on.
Let's move on. Not quite sure if this turns into another manufacturing story or not, but according to Wattcar this week, the new Fiat Tipo, so that is Fiat's new midsize?
Yes, mid-size, the Focus,
I think is the correct term. Focused Astra Golf size hatchback has been through the NCAP rating. And there's now a sort of dual rating system that NCAP do. So they do one which is the sort of basic standard car, and then they do another car with all the optional safety equipment that you can throw at it. And if I were you and I were buying a Fiat Tipo, I would be making sure I buy all the optional safety optional safety equipment, to be perfectly honest. For 500 quid, because the standard car came away with a mere 3-star safety rating from Euro NCAP, which is not good. I mean, basically a 4.5, 5-star rating is what most new cars come through with.
Well, it's only got 4 with the package on.
Yes. Well, the safety package, by the way... is £500 on top of the standard £12,995 for the hatchback, and it includes adaptive cruise control, a speed limiter and autonomous emergency braking. So autonomous emergency braking is the safety system that uses radar and sensors to monitor other vehicles in front of the car, and if it detects that the car's about to crash, it can apply the brakes itself, generally faster than drivers can.
Well, which is a shame that it got such low rating, but we were told when it was revealed at the time that it wasn't going to be destined for the UK, that it was not for our market, it wasn't for the European market, really.
Was that not the saloon version?
I thought it was the car itself, and
no,
then,
I think,
then
I think
on the back of it, of seemingly nearly all of my Twitter going, oh, but we want it because it's a depot and we remember the original, which was Ace.
Well, I'm glad I wasn't part of your Twitter at that point, because I saw it in Geneva and thought it's the dullest thing in the world.
But I've spoken to a few who were on the recent UK North Wales launch.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really impressed with how it drives. So you think if you can get all that right...
Yeah.
You need to get the... I mean... All its major rivals have 5 stars.
Yes.
So, okay, it's significantly cheaper, but...
Yeah, you'd hope that isn't the thing that suffers. Did you see, related to this, and absolutely not in our running order, this is me going off on a tangent, did you see the that essentially a Nissan Sunny, an early Nissan Sunny, that they were still built in Mexico, actually got 0 stars? It got an absolute 0 rating.
No, I saw something on Twitter, but I didn't have a chance to
So Nissan have stopped making it because it's been deemed too dangerous.
But this is all part of NCAP's campaign, isn't it?
Yes.
NCAP are saying, hang on, it is not acceptable that you are providing 5-star stuff in more affluent countries, mm-hmm. yet you will ship 1- and 2-star stuff out to third world countries.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the cost and things like that have to be reflected because, you know, as NCAP have said... Mm-hmm. You know, we are demanding to get 5 stars. We are demanding that it has autonomous braking for people stepping out in front of cars and things like that. It has to have this safety package, otherwise it cannot get 5 stars. So
yeah, but structurally,
but yeah, it's still structurally, it should be able to, you know, minimise hurt in the cabin and all that things. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's how long has that been going on in this country now? I mean, you know, well, in Europe and America, we've had that for quite a while now, haven't we?
Yeah.
The structural integrity and there's lots of programs about how they make the forces dissipate over the length of a car or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes, there is. Yeah. No, I think that NCAP is doing the right thing. I really do. So so here's hoping there's a round of revisions that'll sort this out. Sort this out pretty quickly. But it's unusual for cars not to. Yeah, you'd think it would have been thought about.
It stands out because it isn't.
Yeah, basically, that's it. It's merely adequate.
Mm.
And it stands out because it is. Especially on such a sales note, you know, it really is something that people care about.
Mm.
So, yeah, that seems somewhat strange. Anyhow, let's take a couple of quick minutes. For me to do, as I say here, the podcast equivalent of donning a Pudsey Bear suit and shaking a bucket in your general direction. It is coming up to comic relief time again. But we're not asking you for money. All we ask of you is a few moments of your time to leave a star rating and a review for us via the podcast playing platform of your choice. The most popular and powerful podcasting platform of all is iTunes, so if possible, a 5-star rating there is hugely influential. It only takes you a few moments, and it means a lot to us, making us much more visible to potential new listeners. Similarly, other podcast apps, such as Stitcher, Downcast, Overcast, and the like, all have a rating mechanism, and a rating means a lot, so thank you very much. If you've already rated us, already left a review, and many of you have, so thank you very much again. Then don't forget to tell a friend, maybe show them how to subscribe on their phone on how to get hold of a podcasting app. That's enough word from our not a sponsor. So moving on, Andrew, the Renault Zoe.
Yep, just a quick one, because we talked about it when we ran through Paris. And the highs and lows. With our clothes on.
It's a Marianne Faithfull song about that. And that's driving through Paris in a sports car with the wind in her hair. There you go.
Okay.
I'll stop now.
Yeah, well, the 250-mile range, as judged by boffins, on a single charge, is now in the UK and is for sale. And there, I will have links in show notes to the myriad of ways you can get hold of one and own one, because there are many different ways of doing this. But it's brilliant to see the range go up so significantly. Because that's, again, without trying to bore people too much, we talked about that is the biggest worry. People don't need massive range, but it is an anxiety for people because they're used to the option that if they needed to dash off to the other end of the country, they could, because they could pick up petrol on the way.
Yeah.
So this would make a big difference. So I think it's very good, and it's coming with colours.
It's not just coming with colours. Yes, it is coming with colours, which is great. Three new colours, Mars Red, Titanium Grey, and Yttrium Grey. Ooh.
To add to the Zircon Blue.
It's a nice colour, that. But I also note that they come with a free wall box. So every Zoe, should purchased by a retail customer, will come with a 7-kilowatt fast-charging wall box with free home installation. That should mean that you can go from flat to 100% full in 3 to 4 hours, depending on which version of the car you have, which is kind of cool. So we talked about that when it came with the Outlander Fev. But no, it's actually included with the Zoe now.
Good. I think to help increase adoption, that has to be the way that manufacturers go. And I think that whoever is providing the box for whichever companies will, you know, they'll be guaranteeing income that way as well.
Well, there's that. And the other thing they're doing is they're actually simplifying the charge, the going out and buying charging, if you're out and about, in that they're actually coming out with new apps which will let you sign up and pay for your sort of away from home charging as well, to try and simplify that and not turning up and finding out it's a charger that you don't necessarily have a code for or an agreement with.
Yeah, that's
so they really are
very
trying to
silly. Sort of understand it from the slightly wild westy element that is charging at the moment, because people are trying to establish who are the players and not. Because you know, if you just looked at mainstream press, you'd only think Tesla was the only one out there.
Yeah, totally. So Renault are doing this. They've got this ZePass app, which is developed in association with Bosch. And the idea is that it can locate nearby charging points and compare different prices as well, without having to be registered members of all the different networks, and of course all the hassle that brings with it. So that seems pretty darned clever. And another, you know, a whole bunch of, it just helps easy experience.
But that's
because, let's face it, we're all scared of infrastructure. We all want the cars. Well, many of you and I, Andrew, both want the cars, and many like us, but we are slightly scared of the infrastructure. So simplifying that infrastructure is what matters.
Absolutely. Make it as simple and as easy as possible, and people will come on board because they just don't want the hassle. You know, they are prepared to pay more by walking to a, you know, driving up into a garage, sticking a nozzle in for, you know, a couple of minutes, going and paying a lot of money to then drive on, rather than sit there and think about something about their route and where they have to stop on the way and things like that.
So yeah.
If we can, fair enough, all these different companies have their own charging points, but if they could all speak to one central hub that allows anyone to use them as long as they have the right adapter, because, I mean, hopefully we're getting over that issue.
Mm-hmm. I hope so.
Because that's very... Well, I mean, if we can't do it for phones...
Well, this is true, yes.
My hopes are not high.
Well, very marginally less data transfer. From phones, yeah.
That we can do it right, we can do it a better way.
Hmm. But no, it's no. I'm really pleased about that. I think the Zoe is a lovely little car. No, and I'm glad that, and with that range, 250 miles will get you quite far before it's time to stop and stop charge, and it probably is time to go.
Considering it's supposed to be something like 20 miles or 25 miles is supposed to be the average commute as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone for the people who would have that as a second car that wouldn't do that sort of mileage anyway.
Yes, yeah. It's really, by the way, the NEDC range, which is the who are the boffins that Andrew referred to earlier on, is 250 miles. Renault are saying that in temperate conditions it's looking to be about 186 miles, and in extreme cold 124 miles is what you can really expect in the real world. So they are, I mean, and they get to that bit in the second paragraph of this press release. So they are being very realistic about that and saying, well, it's actually, you know, I know it's 250 mile calculated range, but really it's 186 or 124 miles. So it's somewhere in that band, which is still, should be more than enough.
Yes. Absolutely. Right, let's move on.
Yes, let's. And
to more
we'll go
of the future.
From a delightful future to the future. And this is...
Well, you're finally going to announce we're all going to get hoverboards, aren't you?
It's only a smidgen away from that. Basically, in a white paper published on the Uber website, their chief product officer, Jeff Holden, talked all about vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, which is essentially a flying car.
Because they're so easy to do.
Oh, they have been a success for many years. I can't remember the name of that American company that has been... It's been the thing for years, and they still seem to hang around.
Well, they've sorted out... you mean the prop one that the wings tilt on, yeah? I can't remember
that's
the name.
One, of that's one of them. There's another one with, like, four...
The Osprey. Was
fans.
It the Osprey they call it?
The Osprey is a... Oh, it's got Rolls-Royce engines. The Osprey is a military aircraft that does that, yes.
Yeah,
it has
that they had lots of problems for many years, but they seem to have sorted them out now.
Allegedly,
apparently,
yes.
Yes.
That's not what I had someone from Rolls-Royce describe it as recently.
Okay.
Yeah. So, anyway...
So, this really easy and
so this really
commonplace
easy concept.
Type of transport medium. Uber think that's the future for traveling, taking us around the mega cities of tomorrow. Is that?
Well, they have described it, and here I quote from a quotation included in Rachel Burgess in Autocar, that it is the rapid, reliable transport between suburbs and cities, and ultimately within cities. It's a thought piece, blue sky thinking by Uber. No vehicle manufacturer to date has yet demonstrated a commercially viable aircraft featuring DEP, that's distributed electric propulsion. So there is real risk here. Basically, they want to see if they can basically have driverless, flying, droney things taking us around cities instead of autonomous vehicles on the roads.
What I want to know is
just
with all this free time
thinking.
We're going to have, whether it's because we've been made unemployed or whether it's because somebody else is driving us, or something else is driving us, what are we going to do?
It's going to be like computers, Andrew. Now, computers are going to free us up from the hardships of daily life and dull drudgery so that we can all play volleyball with each other and enjoy active outdoor lifestyles.
Oh, I look forward to taking up skiing then.
But yes, the firm itself is describing that the vision that we've sort of laughed at as ambitious, but believes achievable in the coming decade if all the key factors in the VTOL ecosystem, so that's regulators, vehicle designers, communities, cities, and network operators, collaborate effectively. I am a nasty, cynical
person.
The
coming decade?
I don't believe. Yeah. I think there should be an S on there. No. It is. I think they're looking to... They're trying to look past past autonomous vehicles on roads, as we think. And
so was this them actually putting a nose up at Tesla's announcement? You can't do Ubering in our cars. You can only use our system.
I don't think it's. No, not really. I think it is just purely a thought piece. Which to put out just to.
Yawning. Don't blame me.
Which they put out to trigger debate
to encourage the conversation.
Well, it's a kind of I've had this idea. I write it down in a white paper and see what happens. And if we manage it, that's cool. And we'll make a big thing about how we announced that we were going to manage it. If we don't manage it, then basically everybody will have forgotten by then anyway, so I wouldn't worry about it. So that's... yes. Moving back, something closer to reality when it comes to autonomous vehicles. Tell me about Budweiser.
Well, Budweiser is typically served in a brown bottle and gives me a stunning headache right between my eyes. No,
Yes.
It does actually do that. I can't drink it.
Anyway, never mind.
We have talked. Yes, everybody really needed to know that.
Yes, thank you.
We have talked a few times about autonomous lorries and trials that we're going to go on in the UK, namely in Cumbria, the M6, and of platooning, which Alan had to remind me what the word was again. But basically, the lorries travelling very close in convoy behind each other to maximise efficiency and vehicle-to-vehicle communications and that sort of thing. Well, in America, a full lorry of said alcoholic beverage, other alcoholic beverages are available.
Very mildly alcoholic.
Well, was driven 120 miles across Colorado.
Well, I think it drove itself, didn't it?
Well, the beer was driven.
Oh, the beer was driven, yes, pardon me.
And this was done autonomously. If I remember correctly, it joined the highway or the freeway itself.
Mm-hmm.
The picture's a bit disturbing. One of the pictures, because it just shows, it must have freaked out people driving near it, because it's this lorry cab, picture pointing back, and there's nobody in the cab.
Oh, did you see it? No, there was someone in the cab, but he was in the cabin, but he was lying on the bunk. He wasn't even sitting in there. He wasn't sitting in the seat. He didn't have his hands near the wheel, his feet near the pedals. He was actually sitting in the bunk. Supposedly that had been checked, and that was okay with the highways people and the safety folk. Merca.
Drive more than 30 seconds without taking your hands off a steering wheel of a car at the moment.
So there's... Well, I would hope you don't have your hands off the wheel for 30... There is another picture which showed from the other angle, and the chap was sprawling on the bunk and you could see the road through the windscreen in the distance. So he wasn't sitting in the driver's seat. So it must have been pretty terrifying if you could see in.
But you can see why. I mean, it's easier to see why haulage and commercial vehicles would be autonomized before more typically private owned vehicles, because of the type of work they're doing, and the fact that it is work. It is not just going out for a bit of a fun drive or going to work or something like that. It is a job, it is a process, and the human being is expensive.
Yes.
And the human being legally has to stop after so many hours.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if this is autonomous, it could keep going as long as, you know, the vehicle is not contravening certain standards that will obviously have to be agreed to. You know, if the vehicle looks like it's going to break down or something, or something's going to go wrong with it, it'll have to stop at that point. But it just makes perfect sense if any element is going to be autonomized that it goes that way first, because businesses, or business in inverted commas, and I'll hurt myself later for saying that, will be able to more readily absorb that cost than, say, a single person buying a car.
Yes.
Through the economies of scale and things like that.
Right. It's fleet purchasing and all that kind of stuff. So what we've missed out is actually who it was that was running this test. Just Anheuser-Busch. It was a company called Otto, which is a Canadian company based in Ontario. And their part, they specialize in autonomous vehicles and have tried, you know, normal size as well. But they're aiming towards the serve that commercial market that you were just talking about there, Andrew, in exactly the way you've just been saying. But they're actually a subdivision of someone called Clearpath Robotics, who make all-terrain robots for industrial applications. So, you know, when you see those robots zipping around Amazon distribution centers and things, then those are ClearPath robots. So there is, it's not just some brand new startup. Well, it was, but they got bought by ClearPath.
Well, I know Canada is working very hard to make themselves a center for autonomous transport.
Well, they've got plenty of space for it all to go wrong and very few people.
Yeah.
The dullest drives I've ever done was Montreal to Toronto, by the way. If you ever want to be really bored at the wheel of a car, I can recommend that one. In a Hyundai accent. Not just that, a basic spec American Hyundai accent, not even a pleasant European. But yeah, so that's who it was. It was Otto that was running that in collaboration with Anheuser-Busch. There were no accidents, which meant that 50,000 bottles of Budweiser was not taken off the shelves.
Right, let's move on.
Yes, let's. Andrew, again, Future of Vehicles, Royal College of Art.
Yes, and their vehicle design competition for 2016. The winner was announced today, I think.
Yes, it was.
No, yesterday, sorry.
All right.
And this is in conjunction with the RAC, I think, isn't it? Yeah.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, with the RAC.
It's the RAC and the RCA.
Yes, there's too many R's and C's and A's. Maybe in those order. In that order. But basically what happens is that the students put forward nomination or put forward designs for futuristic vehicles. They're obviously given a spec to design to. And this year the winner was Yang Li.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
I'm really sorry if I've butchered your name there. I really do apologise. With Pure, which is a two-wheeled vehicle, basically. It's got two seats, and it's taken it... think there's things like taking it back to its essence and things like that. So I don't think I'd be leaping into it, I must admit.
It's
a fairer weathered or fairer climated vehicle, I think, than ours.
Yes. The theme, by the way, this year was continental connection. Okay, which encouraged students to take inspiration from the pioneering vehicles of the London to Brighton run. Okay, so that's why if you're looking at some of these, then you'll see that there's a very strong vintage vehicle theme in there and vintage vehicle feel to some of these. So even though they are really quite radical, there's pretty heavy on spoked wheels and sort of canopies and hoods rather than being super streamlined pods that we would almost expect, really. From commercial view.
Mm.
Yes, I was trying to see where the exhibition is, actually. I don't know if it is in the Royal College of Art or in the RAC.
Yeah.
No, I can't see that. Maybe find that. We'll try and find that out and let you guys know via Twitter or some other way. No, still can't see it. We'll try and see if we can find out where that is. And post it on Twitter or something afterwards.
Mm.
Cool. So that's that. Future of motoring. A little bit of a throwback. This week's list of the week. I do sometimes feel we need a little bit of intro music there. List of the week this week comes as ever from Motoring Research, because I'm sorry, they produce the most interesting lists. If you've got better lists than Motoring Research and Gavin Braithwaite-Smith, then please publish them and let us know.
Yes, do let us know.
We're always interested in a fun old list. So this week is a topic dear to my heart. Some of the best looking Japanese cars ever, and I think we've got eight or so, I think.
A few.
Yeah, there's quite a few, actually. So I shall zip through them very, very quickly. I think some of these are absolutely brilliant. First one is really it's really not that much of a surprise. It is the Toyota 2000 GT, essentially the Japanese E-Type, which started life as a Yamaha, well, it was developed and engineered by Yamaha. And then produced by Toyota. Actually, I think that the best versions of that are one of the... I think there were two convertibles made for the James Bond movie, You Only Live Twice, in white. And those
You'll be wrong, because it's in white and it's convertible.
Ah, that's... But it's... Yes. Yes, but it was also a Bond movie, and therefore it's allowed. Next up, another fantastic two-seater in my mind, the RX-7 FD.
Yes.
So that's the last generation RX-7. The one that's most likely to set fire to itself from its rotary engine. But absolutely a lovely, lovely car, and supposedly fantastic to drive. The purer, the better, really.
Yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Good luck. Next up, some of the very earliest Toyota Celicas. I never even remember that exists. And then the Datsun 240Z. There's a couple of predictable Nissans coming here. The 240Z, the original Z car. It was designed by Count somebody or other. Name I forget right now. But yes, a wonderful looking car. Lots of E-Type influence there as well. The original Nissan Skyline GTR, the PGC10 model.
I love that. I love that.
They are fantastic. They're really great looking cars. And the trouble, of course, this day and age is finding unmolested ones. But yeah, wing mounted conical rear view mirrors, anyone? They properly are wing mirrors, actually.
Yes.
Which is fantastic, even in four-door saloon, because everybody forgets that the Skyline is really a saloon car. The Lexus LFA, something that caused us to scroll back and check that it was best-looking and not most beautiful. I think that's a wonderful-looking car. If you've ever seen one in the flesh, and there aren't that many to see, But if you ever see one in the flesh, they are really quite wonderful looking. Nissan 300ZX, Z32 model. Again, 300ZX turbo. Great looking car from that period in the sort of late 80s into the early 90s when Japanese manufacturers were really innovating there. I mean, this was a car that had, most of them had four-wheel steering. I think some of them had steering headlamps. It was a curious car. They actually sold it in two versions, a two-seat and a 2+2. And you can tell which is which because of the location of the fuel cap. So the one in the picture there, I think, is a two-seater. I'm so prepared to be wrong on some of this. Next up, Honda NSX. I'm sure I'm not wrong, though, and that's the most scary part of it all for me. Next one's the Honda NSX. Yeah, yes, the please. Original Honda NSX. All the time. Yep. Every time. Yep. Mazda Cosmo. Just also a wonderful UFO. With its twin rotor engine, it must have been quite something. Real Jetsons-tastic, the Mazda Cosmo. I don't think I've ever seen one in the flesh.
No.
So not on the road. Mark 1 Toyota MR2.
Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Perfect until that first roundabout in a slippery day like today. It's cool.
I was going to say the design was perfect.
The design, yes. Yes, it's perfect. I would rather own the next one, the Subaru XT, which is slightly batty. And you can see where the SVX inspiration came from. Mm. Crazy things about the XT. XT had a digital dashboard and an asymmetric steering wheel as well.
Oh, there that must go. Have been really lovely to use.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing was it not something to do with the faster you went, the faster the wipers went as well? Oh, there was some link in there between the two of them. I know exactly who's the man to it. The man who knows these things, but he works for another company that sells flat four engine cars. Coincidentally, or not so coincidentally. original Datsun Cherries.
The picture. Have you noticed the
difference in paint color halfway along? That might just be the photo. It does look really bad.
So they've got halfway through gone, oh, we'll still take a picture because we're very proud.
Yes, it's half polished. That's probably original. That's barn find, that is. It's worth $3 million.
No, there's no straw bales artfully put around it to prove that it was a barn.
No. No. Next up, original Honda CRX.
Oh, I love
fantastic
the look of these.
Car. Lovely. Lovely. I'm a bit of a... I prefer the slightly rounder, slightly later ones with that lower back window, which the current Civic kind of harks back to in having that two-part back window. Mm. But that makes me a non-purist, so people laugh
at me. And wrong.
And wrong. No, I'm not. What I am right at is that the Giorgetto Giugiaro designed... Isuzu Piazza, which was originally the ace of Fiori. Is that clubs or spades? Oh, damn. Yes, the Asso di Fiori concept car that was turned into the front-wheel drive Isuzu Piazza. It's a very striking-looking vehicle. I'm going to say that.
Hmm.
I believe that the understeer and the torque steer are quite fantastic, especially in the later turbo engine ones. But I'm sure someone...
Is that fantastic in a scary way, or just fantastic?
Supposedly it was quite scary. I'm told. And last but not least, the original NA Mazda MX-5, because it is the cutest little sports car out there. When it's not being covered in stuff. There's one around here which seems to have been sprayed with pure Smurf. It is just this gross matte blue colour. It's just plastered it. But yeah. I'm a huge fan of MX-5 fandom, etc. Cool. Far more detail in the list itself, so please follow the link in the show notes, make your way over to motoringresearch.com and have a little look at the list and enjoy it. There's a full list. There's a full top 40 on MSN cars as well. I was going to say, when you click, don't forget to tell them we sent you, but it's kind of hard on the website. So, yeah. last, I seem to have got a run of stuff in a row here. Last but not least, finally this week, it is the London to Brighton car run on Sunday. So don't forget to make way that Sunday, the 6th of November, to make your way to the mall, isn't it, that they start from?
I think so.
To make your way to the mall and to wave everyone off, and also to check out the website, which is veterancarrun.com, to see what the route is, and where the best places to get pictures and to see the cars. I'm heading... Oh, gee whiz.
Ding.
Pardon me. I'm heading north this weekend, so I'm not going to be about for it, sadly. But yeah, go have a look and see what's happening. See where you can support, wave and cheer people on Sunday morning. And of course, tied into that is the Regent Street Motor Show. So all day on Saturday, if you are in central London, and in Regent Street, then you'll be able to see displays of it. Regent Street will be closed to normal passing through traffic, and you'll be able to see displays of the cars that will be doing the London to Brighton run. There'll be stunt displays, all sorts of bits and pieces, and again, classic motoring today sections, all sorts of bits and pieces, and of course, showing off low emission vehicles on Regent Street as well. So, and it's all free, 10:30 a.m. till 4 p.m. on Saturday. You'd think they'd sponsor us or something, wouldn't you? So yeah, between Piccadilly Circus and Oxford Circus. So get along there if you happen to be in London. I think that just about rounds it up for this week, doesn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. I'm amazed we managed to not get too political or go on for too long about Nissan. Which was a pleasant surprise.
Well, we'll see whether people agree with
that. I thought we were pretty reasonable. Anyway, moving on from that, I'll actually see you before the next show. That's quite scary, isn't it?
Not if I see you first, but yes.
Not
yes,
if you see me first.
Yes, yes, you will. I'm joking. Joking, ladies and gentlemen, yes. Of course. Yes, it is always a pleasure to see Alan. It's very rare that we actually manage it.
Yeah, quite. And on Friday, I will be trying to send Andrew off on a walking tour of motoring sites of London. If anybody has any good suggestions, then please feel free to tweet us at Motoring Podcast for the show. And the same goes for any feedback or any other thoughts you have. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us at Motoring Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, on Facebook, and on the contact page of motoringpodcast.com, which is the hub of all our activities. Please don't forget to leave a review and a rating on iTunes or however your podcast app lets you do such a thing. It really, really does matter. Andrew, best way to get in touch with you?
Best way would be via Twitter. If you search for Crack Windscreen, you will find me. And Alan, best way for them to get in touch with you personally?
Personally? I'm going to take that word out of this. Right up. then it is best again to use Twitter, where I'm at AJP Bradley, BIADLEY. We'll both be back next week. Andrew will be back with another rear view on Friday as well. But until then, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.